You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a light but not sunny day. It's actually quite pretty outside, but there's no sunshine.
It's beautiful if you're walking around or driving very, very slowly. It's a foggy day here in the Sacramento Valley. Temperature right now at the Sacramento Executive Airport is 44 degrees. And at the Davis Airport, it's 45 degrees. Humidity is 100%. Wind speed is zero. It's a high pressure ridge parked over us, and we're having another foggy morning going into the mid-afternoon. High temperature today as we record the program on January 21 for broadcast on January 22. High temperature today is going to be 53. Low tonight will be 47 with dense fog. And I mean really dense fog. I've lived here, like Lois, for many, many years. The fog that we've had just after sunset the last few days has been among the densest and most dangerous to drive in that I've seen since I moved here. We used to have this kind of foggy weather in the 70s and 80s, and everybody kind of got used to it. It's largely gone away in the last few decades, and every now and then we'll get an episode of Thule fog, and it can be quite frightening when you realize that many of the people sharing the road with you have never driven where the visibility is about 30 feet ahead of you. Dense fog is going to continue, but we've got some clouds coming in Thursday night, and we had had some hope that we might see a little rain, but that's completely fallen out of the forecast. Thursday night will be 44 with increasing clouds. Friday, 57. Partly sunny. Friday night, 42, partly cloudy. Saturday, 60 and sunny. That'll be beautiful. And because it'll be clear, it'll be 38 degrees Saturday night with then some clouds forming. Sunday, partly sunny, 54. Sunday night, 39. Monday, partly sunny, 56. Monday night, 38. And Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a high near 57. So you get the pattern. Either high clouds or fog, take your pick, and intervals of sunshine for a couple hours in the afternoon where we all run outside and shout with delight at how pretty it suddenly is. There is a dense.
It's so cold, Don. I really should leave town pretty soon. It's cold and wet and rainy. Well, it isn't even rainy. It's just foggy.
Well, we're not getting freezing weather, but it's just in the 40s for much of the day. The chilling hours, this will give you some indication of how things are doing. We have had, using the Utah model of 34 to 50 degrees, we've had 998 chilling hours in Davis, which puts us just below the highest amount in the last, let's say, 6 years that I'm looking at here. We're well above what almost any of the deciduous stone fruits and palm fruits would need in this area. So chilling hours are definitely not going to be a problem for us. And that's,
we're still getting what, 22, 23 hours a day.
Yesterday we got 21.5 chilling hours. The day before we got 22.5 chilling hours out of a 24 hour day. So yeah, we're getting a lot of chilling hours, and they do continue to accumulate. Old model that I learned way back when put you through the month of February. You would be counting chilling hours November 1 to February 28. That was fairly arbitrary, but that gives you a good basis for comparison. Let's just say we're going to be on the high end of chilling hours this year. Nothing to worry about in the valley. But I did just take a quick look at Escondido as an example, which is an interior part of San Diego County. And they've had about half their normal chilling hours. Much of the state is below average on chilling hours. In fact, we've had a very strange phenomenon in California. If you want to read a good summary, our good friend over there, Daniel Swain at weatherwest.com, I'll keep this short, he says. It has been an absurdly warm winter thus far across nearly the entire American West. including most of California. One of the only exceptions has been California's Central Valley, where episodes of Thule fog have kept conditions colder and damper for days at a stretch. Mm-hmm. Lack of any major cold outbreaks have kept conditions among the top five warmest winters on record to date. This is all the more remarkable given that it has actually been quite a wet start to the season across much of the Pacific Northwest and Southern California. Here it has been warm and wet, as opposed to the more recently familiar warm and dry, but anomalous to record warmth remains the rule, and I don't see that changing, he says, over the next couple of weeks. Snowpack conditions are terrible across most of the West as a result. In fact, as of this writing, 2 days ago, every single Western state has at least one snow water reporting site logging record low values for mid-January, except for the Northern Rockies and Southern Sierra, where heavy precipitation in very high elevation basins has outweighed the effects of record warmth. Snowpack is far below average levels for the time of year at singular record lows in numerous locations, most concentrated in Utah and Colorado, but widespread elsewhere, and especially at lower elevations. Here in Davis, we've had about 12 inches of rain, 12 to 13 inches of rain, which is just about average for this time of year. But we would be gaining a couple more inches typically in January, and I don't see any sign of that, at least in the long-range forecast. We can, of course, get a lot of rain here in February, a lot of rain here in March. Lake Berryessa is only 3 feet from the overflow. So Lake Berryessa has lots of water, and it's almost a certainty that if we get anything close to average rainfall in February, that it will overflow the so-called glory hole. Announcements, let's see, you have something in front of you.
I actually have one coming up in February 14th. Wait a minute. Isn't that Valentine's Day?
It is, yes.
Well, then y'all can bring your sweetie and head on out to the Fair Oaks Horticultural Center. Open garden! And these are things that happen periodically. They're free events where you can roam the garden, watch what they're doing, see what they're growing, and ask questions. Love is in the air at the Horticultural Center. Presentations on Valentine's Day include Keep Fruit Trees Small with Abundant Harvest. Yep. Fruit tree planting demonstration. I love the fact that it's hands-on. It's not just a slideshow. Yeah. Blueberry pruning for optimal growth and fruit production.
That's a good one,
Ornamental grass pruning made easy.
That's really easy. You just tether a goat next to the grass plant.
No.
I want to mention that this the garden out there was spearheaded by Chuck Ingalls, who was a farm advisor in Sacramento County, longtime Davis resident, passed away a number of years ago. So they're honoring him at this event. Chuck Ingalls was did a lot for outreach. That's part of the job of being a farm advisor, but in my opinion, he was especially good at it. And these demonstration gardens were you know, his brainchild many years ago, planting trees close together to show how you do it, summer pruning of fruit trees, base training versus the other forms of training and so forth. There's also a great book that they have mentioned. It's been around for a while, The Home Orchard. It is now expanded. Second edition has just been published. And this covers site selection, varieties, pruning, grafting, irrigation, pest management. It's expanded beyond peaches and apples and now includes figs, persimmons, nuts. So that's almonds, walnuts, pecans, chestnuts. Did you know you can grow chestnuts here? Filberts, pistachios with crop by crop calendars providing essential tasks. You can buy this directly from the UCANR catalog. So just go to ucanr.edu, look at their book catalog, and the book is called, it's really easy to remember, The Home Orchard. So this is an announcement that a new edition, greatly expanded, of this already incredible resource is out there. So head on out to the Fair Oaks Horticulture Center on Valentine's Day for some great hands-on demonstrations. Walk around, take a look at the way they're training, pruning, take a look at the vegetable gardens and all the beds and the things that they've created out there. But especially, the focus has been for almost two decades now, how you, gardeners, can get more fruit out of your backyard easily. There you go. It's not hard.
If you want to go out there, the address is 11549 Fair Oaks Boulevard. That's in Fair Oaks, California. And you know, if you can't remember that, just go to UCANR.
Yeah, ucanr.edu and the Master Gardeners. This is Sacramento County Master Gardener event page. Open garden on Valentine's Day. What a great thing to do with your sweetie. We've got a catered alert. Please welcome our newest program to the KDRT airwaves, the YOLO Backyard Bulletin with host Jesse Drew, sharing news and views about what's going down in YOLO County. Tune in Thursdays from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California.
All right. Well, let's get started here. I mean, we've got so much to talk about.
In the Davis Enterprise, for those of you who are subscribers, on Sunday, that would be, let's see, the 17th. Have I got the calendar right? I think so. I had an article about training, selecting and training fruit trees. The article is titled Getting Started with Fruit Trees. And it was some of the things we talk about here on the show quite a bit, which varieties I recommend. Real quick overview. I mean, of the peaches, I gave four. You know, there's 100 varieties you could choose from. But it gave some quick overview on that and the training techniques that we've talked about on the show. I got some great illustrations from Oregon State University. So we went ahead and popped them into the article. So if you are a subscriber to the Davis Enterprise, look for last Sunday's article, my name, Don Shore, Getting Started with Fruit Trees, and he spread it over 2 pages, but my editor there is great. It was lots of coverage. So it's there. If you don't happen to be a subscriber to the Davis Enterprise, it will be up at Davis Garden Show, excuse me, at redwoodbarn.com, my business website, shortly. So it'll be there and you can look for it at redwoodbarn.com. We've talked about these, which varieties do I recommend? And I'm going to really briefly tell you that that's something you should inquire locally, wherever you're listening. I have varieties that I highly recommend here in the Valley. If I were making a recommendation for Southern California, it would be probably a rather different list. Chilling hours would be a factor, but also tolerance for different growing conditions. So that is the kind of thing where your local master gardeners, your local cooperative extension folks, your local garden centers, obviously, can be very, very helpful. I don't want to diss the places that aren't nurseries, but I'm going to. Many of them, the chains, shall we call them, bring in fruit tree assortments in January, bare root. They're often in plastic bags. That's my first issue, is that the roots are in plastic bags, so they've been pruned to put them in there. Okay, that's not great. But really, what bothered me in the years when I was going down helping my parents as they were aging and seeing these assortments at, let's see, the grocery store. I mean, places like that. They'd be out front. Oh, look, they're selling fruit trees. They were insanely inappropriate. I mean, they were like Bing cherries that need 800 chilling hours in La Jolla, California, which gets 50. So there was no one within 100 miles of there that would be growing Bing cherries successfully. So I don't want to say don't buy them at those places, but let's just say be informed if you're purchasing at those places. Check the labels. The labels by the manufacturer. The growers are very good. Or even better would be to go to a place that actually knows the fruit trees, like your local garden center or even the hardware store that's local, not a big, big chain. You'll get better results that way. Enough of that rant.
Before you leave that rant, I have a suggestion for our listeners, which is if you know that you need at least 500 chilling hours, I mean, that you don't get any more than that, go to those lists of hundreds of peaches that they have, find the one that's ranked by chilling hours, and simply cross off all the things you use and take a picture of the ones that you can. And then just carry that around on your phone. And whenever you decide that you want to buy, oh, that's a nice peach, look it up, see if it's on the list.
Well, one thing that's happened in the bare root industry is we're down to one supplier. This is something people need to know. Dave Wilson Nursery is a phenomenal resource. That's the supplier of fruit trees to almost every retail garden center and hardware store in not just California, but the entire West at this point, as far as I can tell. I'm sure there's others out there, but it's the big one. The other is Ellie Cook Company, went out of business in 2017. So that, you know, they're gone. The Dave Wilson Nursery website is an incredible resource. It has all the information you need about all these different varieties and a lot of recommendations. More to the point, they will give you a list, if you look, of what they sent to different nurseries. So yeah, there's a nursery I know of locally that doesn't ever have a list of their fruit trees. They never make their own list. And someone contacted them on Facebook and said, where's your list? And they said, we don't have one. And I wanted to chime in. You guys know you actually have a list. At the Dave Wilson Nursery website, it's there. What you ordered is there for the public to see. So wherever you are, you can go in and it's in the where to buy, you know, for home gardeners. And we're on there. Redwood Barn Nursery, Davis Ace is on there. Lemuria Nursery and Dixon is on there. Everyone who orders from them, what we ordered is there. It's provided for you. It's sorted by county. So you can already check out what the nursery near you has, even if they don't know they have that list. You have to understand that some of the things on that list will be grayed out. That means they ordered them and didn't get them. So they don't absolutely have everything that's on there. We always have shortages in this industry. We have, you know, we have things that don't happen. We have Well, like we talked about, the pear shortage, the great pear tree shortage of 2026 that we'll all be talking about to our grandchildren. The fact that they just weren't available on that particular rootstock. Well, that'll be grayed out. But you know what they ordered anyway. So you can take that list and you can circle the ones you want. You can go into that nursery and they probably have it. And it's also an incredible resource because for decades now, they've been doing tasting events. Fruit tastings, very big, professionally run fruit tastings. We attended
some. How do I get into that, Don?
Well, I don't know where they're doing them now. We attended some at their site 25, 30 years ago. It must have been because we took our kids and they had a great time. And they brought people in the nursery industry and landscapers. You know, there are a bunch of people there and they had carefully saved fruit and they had them through the summer. And we went down there and we tasted peaches. And more to the point, they saved the results from these year after year after year and acquired quite a database of fruit tasting responses. And of course, the bigger your data set, the more useful this is. They have hundreds and hundreds of people giving input on fruit varieties. And so as you're reading through their descriptions, it'll say taste trial winner or, you know, taste test winner in, and so on. So you can see what most people thought. What I thought was interesting about that at the time was most of us were rating pretty similarly. You know, this is a higher acid, higher sugar peach. People would really like it. But this one guy I sat next to, the only peaches he liked were the very low acid, high sugar ones. The sweet, to me, bland, but he thought, now there's a peach. He kept going on, all these peaches are unripe. I don't like this one. Why don't you have ripe peaches? And then we'd get one of the, say, like one of the white peaches that's really high sugar, very low acidity, and he would give that a 10. He would just thought that was the highest rated one. It taught me a couple of things. One, the bigger your data set, the better, because it'll account for anomalous people like him. And as a retailer, I need to know that there are anomalous people like him who have a strong preference for a particular style of fruit. So sometimes you need to think about that if you're choosing a variety. Anyway, Dave Wilson Nursery is a website that gives you lots of information and it can give you local information about what's available. All right.
So
we have an amusing one here. I've talked a little bit about AI and how it is just hopelessly useless for the field of horticulture. The problem, fundamental problem with AI and horticulture is you have to be a horticulture expert to know how wrong it is. And so everything that I've seen generated, and I have only done this a couple of times because I don't want to waste the world's energy on this. Every answer I've seen about questions like peach leaf curl or blossom end rot, that was a great one. Or dealing with diseases in orchards. Those are three that I actually looked at. Anywhere from 20 to 50% of the output was completely wrong. Completely wrong or misleadingly wrong. Sounding plausible, but misleadingly wrong. But I had a really fun one when someone came in and was asking about neem oil for peach leaf curl. Note, it doesn't work. Neem oil for peach leaf curl. And they had Googled it. And since, you know, all these sites now launch the AI right in front of you, they'd gone into there and it came up with a couple other things for peach leaf curl, including.
Even though copper spray, dormant spray and lime surfer spray.
Lime surfer spray. Yes, they meant sulfur, but surfer, lime surfers.
Are all effective options. You can still try homemade solutions.
Okay, let's start right there. The copper sulfate was taken off the market in 2011, I think it was, and lime sulfur, not surfer, was taken off the market either the year before or the year after that. So we're at least well over a decade where those have not been available in California. And dormant spray,
isn't that one of those two?
Dormant, that's what they are. They're dormant spray.
So I know, but it lists it like there's three different
right.
things. It was dormant spray and surfer spray.
It was, yes, lime surfer spray. It was redundant. So it didn't know the difference between dormant spray and the two common active ingredients in dormant sprays over a decade ago. So that's the first start.
I want to read these paragraphs down.
Yeah, this is great. Go for it.
Make sure to use the correct type of spray for your specific disease and pest problem. Also, follow the instruction manual carefully to avoid harming your peach trees. Never mind if you don't know what spray you should use.
What does that sentence mean?
I don't know. Here's the next one. And this one's going to get me here. Not only is milk. A natural fungicide that can help you control peach leaf curl, but also this is an inexpensive and natural alternative to chemical pesticides. Milk spray will also help you promote the growth of beneficial organisms essential for your peach tree. Don,
okay.
Tell me.
Oh, keep going. No, next sentence.
But no, I mean, okay. However, make sure not to use any chemicals when you're applying this solution.
Here we
Also,
go.
avoid spraying this mixture on trees with milk allergy. As said earlier, please avoid using this mixture on sunny days as it can cause sunburn.
Yeah.
Avoid overusing this mixture too, as it may lead to imbalances in soil pH. Oh my God.
Okay, so where would the notion that milk has any efficacy against peach leaf curl come from? Many years ago, 25, 30 years ago, some research was done on using milk sprays in hoop houses for melons and cucumbers in the United Arab Emirates and Israel, is my recollection, as a prophylactic spray for preventing powdery mildew on certain members of Cucurbitaceae. That is the only plausible connection of milk being any kind of a fungicide that I've ever seen. Certainly, it is not a preventive for peach leaf curl. Peach trees do not have milk allergies. Okay, let me just throw that in there. And in terms of the effect on the soil pH, well, it's somewhat basic, but you'd have to spray an awful lot of it for that to be an issue.
It's so it's to promote the growth of beneficial microorganisms, sure, essential for your peach tree.
Yeah, if you put milk on the soil, certain things will increase as they break it down. I don't know whether they're beneficial or harmful, but it's nonsense framed in a plausible first person narrative style. Someone reading that might think, oh, I can use milk. Hey, let me call the nursery and see if my trees have milk allergies. All right.
Okay. So we're laughing about this because it's so ridiculous.
Yep.
But come on, folks.
There's many of these floating around, and it's not going to get any better. It is definitely not going to get better. So the problem with AI for any horticultural information is it's going to dig deep into all the stuff that's out there, which was already junk, and pull it together in a nice first-person narrative format and sound authoritative. I would suggest not using any of the AI products for horticultural inquiries. I would suggest going back to Google if that's your simplest approach, or here's a thought, start bookmarking pages of value. We have to go way back to what we were doing 30 years ago, bookmarking good pages and looking things up on them. Master Gardener programs, a lot of cooperative extension programs, Oregon State University, Cornell, and Purdue, bearing in mind that they're generally local to their region in terms of information, but at least it's scientifically based. And the AI products are just junk. And unfortunately, you need to be an expert to know that. That's the frustrating problem.
And we have one more little divergent shoot that is now rearing its ugly head. I want to whack that mole. No, I know, no violence. Okay. So I have been seeing on my games on my phone, I've been seeing a lot of ads that purport to be plant specialist apps.
Yeah.
And they've got great names, and there's a whole bunch of them out there.
Yep.
And there are even some where you take your phone and you take a picture of your plant, and it says, "Oh, this is a dragon's tooth plant, and yep, and it's sickly. You should put Coke in it or milk or
that's
or
the problem,
cayenne yeah pepper or whatever." Yeah. So even though something says that it is about plants and it's trying to help you make your houseplants healthy, don't trust it.
Right.
Just don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, don't use
throw
them.
Throw that thing away.
Yeah, if you've got one out there that you think is good, be sure to let us know at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. But every one of the ones that I've looked at so far has been focused on home remedies, and the diagnoses are very inaccurate. Part of that is that houseplant problems, which are what they tended to focus on from the start, are really hard to diagnose. They're usually a multiplicity of problems. It's the whole environment that you need to talk about. We could have a whole conversation about what's been going on with houseplants here in the valley when we've had so little sunshine and such subdued temperatures, causing a lot of sort of interrelated problems on houseplants. Your app isn't going to be subtle like that. It doesn't understand nuance. It doesn't understand complex interactions of the environment. They just go, oh, this needs cinnamon. Hey, you got a question about why your houseplants aren't doing well? Let's take a picture and send it to the davisgardenshow@gmail.com. If you're in this area, I'll tell you, lack of light is the likeliest problem. It's been interesting explaining this to people outside the area because we've had since November many spells, day after day after day, where we've had almost no sunlight. Back in late November and into early December, of course, we had more than 3 weeks straight where the low temperature was 41, the high temperature was 45, literally for more than 3 weeks. And the sunlight was approximately 1/20th of what we would typically get on a summer day. It was less than half. It was less than a quarter in some cases of what we typically get on a winter day. And while you may not think that affects your house plants, it does, because the lights in your house are typically not plant lights. They're typically lights that you like. And so unless you augmented the light for your plants and they were relying on what was coming in through the window, plants were struggling. And we have been seeing yellowing of older leaves and tips burning on the margins. We've been seeing, you know, yellowing of or shedding of interior leaves on some things. And if you do an app or you take a picture and you take it into someplace, they're all going to say, oh, you overwatered it, or you underwatered it, or you did this, or you did that. Very likely, it's a reaction to low light and relatively low temperatures. Even though your house is heated, you probably weren't keeping it as warm as a tropical plant would prefer. So we're seeing effects both indoors and out from the long period of cold temperature, but we've had almost no actual frost. We've had almost no, I don't think we've actually gotten below 32 degrees in town this year. We did briefly on our farm, but in town, I don't think anybody's gotten below 32. They've seen frost on surfaces, but not the kind of frost that damages plants. So what we are seeing is cold injury here in the valley. Those of you outside of the area, you've been enjoying a balmy winter. Here in the valley, we've seen cold injury that wasn't direct, indirect cold injury. The injury based on the low temperature affecting the roots, affecting the plant's ability to photosynthesize, affecting their ability to store the results of photosynthesis, having to shed organs, which includes roots and some leaves, in response to this inability to photosynthesize properly, the temperature damage. But it's not the kind of damage you get when frost is occurring, where cells are rupturing, or actually more typically the moisture between cells is rupturing, where you go out and you see, you know, leaves burnt. It's a term we use, ironically, for damage from direct cold injury. That's when your impatience, you know, melts overnight because of direct cold. No, my impatience, which are still in a pot out there, gradually just looked worse and worse and worse and declined until finally, after 4 or 5 weeks of just sort of slowly yellowing and dying down, not the usual way, not just frozen off, but just dying down gradually, they rotted and collapsed. It wasn't direct cold injury, it was indirect cold injury. We're seeing that. Rest of you, having a great winter in terms of temperatures.
Hey, Don. And what you've been doing lately? What are you growing? What are you harvesting? Anything? Any special tips for this week?
Pruning roses, trying to prune roses, and we're taking a zillion cuttings as we do. So it's been an interesting process to prune and then save cutting material and get it in for production. We're growing most of our own roses now at Redwood Barn Nursery, so I take a lot of them for cutting material.
How do you keep track of what they are?
Oh,
when
that's
you're out there and you're cutting all the stuff. I mean, so you have to know what it is when you're going to sell it.
Super important. Yes, we bind them up and label them before we move on to the next bush. That's actually really, really important. Labeling is a big issue in the nursery industry. So we're pruning them now, pruning roses. I try to get that done if I'm pruning them by the end of January. There's some roses that I have that I don't prune, many roses that I have that I don't prune at all, or I haven't pruned for several years except to take cuttings. And I'm just seeing how they grow as landscape plants. Give you a full report on the head at some point, which ones make good garden plants as well as having nice flowers. That's been something I've been kind of testing for a decade or so here. I'm planting flowers. Believe it or not, wholesale growers actually have pansies, violas, snapdragons, let's see, Iceland poppies. They even have dianthus, which seems to be one they like to do year round. Those are all available finally. We had a long gap there because there was no sunlight. So the Northern California growers, at least the ones here in the valley, the plants were fine, but they weren't blooming because they weren't getting enough light. You know, even in greenhouses where the temperature was regulated, the solar input was low. So they're finally coming into bloom. So if you want to get some color out in your garden, those are some of the things you'll see. Pansies, violas, snapdragons, calendulas. Some of them have calendulas. Poppies, Iceland poppies are great. If you haven't grown them and you have a sunny location, I would definitely put them in there. And you'll find some other things. One of our growers suddenly had ranunculus and anemones in bloom. So there's ways to get
bulbs. Those are bulbs.
Yes, they started the bulbs in probably September, October. They pot them up, and they're mostly in 4-inch and quart pots because they need more of a root system. Those are things that you can plant that'll bloom for 2 to 3 months. Those two in particular, ranunculus and anemones, well, they're quite beautiful and they come in an amazing range of colors, don't usually come back. So plant them as annuals, even though they are, as you mentioned, bulbs, corms, rhizomes, whatever. They just don't usually repeat here. So you plant them as if they were a pansy, viola, snapdragon. But the colors, I mean, there's really true blue in anemones. Ranunculus are stunning flowers. I mean, they're worth it, even though you're basically planting an annual. Some nurseries have bulbs, beginning to grow and bloom. We have some narcissus, for example, little dwarf ones, and some of the daffodils coming up. Some of the tulips are coming up. So you can buy those in growing now to plant for bloom in just a few weeks. We're selling more and more of them that way as the years go by, people buying their daffodils either in bloom or coming into bloom. Well, here's one way to look at it. They are perennials. You know, you're buying a perennial plant that's about to bloom and will come back for years. So even though we all thought of bulbs as a sort of a totally separate category at nurseries, we only display them in the fall. You plant them for their spring bloom. I don't know why more of us don't just plant them up and put them out on the benches with the agapanthus and the daylilies and the others. Those are bulb-like plants. We sell them as perennials. Daffodils we sell as bulbs. Well, you know what? They're a perennial. So put them out in your garden. They're great for low water landscapes. Bulbs are uniquely adapted to drought. That is mainly what bulbs are, actually, is a drought adaptation. So the tulips that we sell, for example, the botanical tulips, the daffodils and narcissus that we sell, will grow, bloom in the spring, go dormant, go through the summer with no irrigation needed. In the summer, they can be in an unirrigated landscape or in an irrigated landscape. They vary somewhat in that regard. And they'll come back and bloom year after year, and in many cases will multiply. That doesn't apply to every bulb, but it does apply at least to the ones that we grow, and a lot of other nurseries do the same. I was at Trader Joe's walking in there, and they had those cute little miniature daffodils, the ones that bloom 4 to 5 inches tall. Varieties called tete-a-tete. That one multiplies like crazy. So if you buy that little $5 or $10 plant and it's done, you can have it in your house to bloom, enjoy it. It's got a light fragrance. Even Lois would probably like it. And a little plant blooming about 6 inches high. When it's done, put it out in your garden someplace. And I've watched that one multiply for years. So many of them are great garden plants that just happen to be sold as if they're a florist item.
So, you know, I have some shady areas in mm-hmm. my yard.
That's more challenging, definitely, but yeah.
And the one that is probably the most challenging, the place where the baby tears would grow. Mm-hmm. It's there's under a Japanese maple. It's shaded by the house. It never gets any sun at all. Yep. It gets indirect light, but no mm-hmm. sun. Are there bulbs that would do well in that situation, in the baby tears situation?
Yes, from my experience, because we planted bulbs in places that were sunny and now are not. Okay, biggest problem on my property is that, you know, I plant too many things
and grow.
The garden bed gets shaded out. Well, I can tell you that snowflake, Leucogium. Leucogium is called snowflake. It looks like snowdrops, but snowflake, similar plant for milder climates like ours. That has done very well. My little kid, who is now 39, my little kid, when she was maybe 5 or 6, like to do this thing I've described, where they would take seeds or bulbs that they would find and they'd sneak out and plant them someplace to play a trick on dad. It was hilarious. You'd be walking along the path and you'd see a whole bunch of bean seedlings coming up because they'd taken a whole package of beans and planted them in one spot. Well, she did that with a Leucogium bulb, one bulb under my Japanese maple, which is now completely shaded in that area. And each year I get 30 or 40 blooms on the multiplicity of plants that have occurred there after she planted it. So it's like a fun reminder. And this is more than 3 decades later that it has increased. So Leucogium definitely has worked for me. Right near it, I planted wood hyacinth, one of the Scilla group, now sold as Hyacinthoides, but Scilla is the old name. And wood hyacinths and Spanish bluebells are closely related. In some places you're listening, they could become invasive. They don't do that here. So they do great here. It's one of these true blue flowers. It pops up, it blooms for a few weeks, it dies down, it's gone. And again, I planted these bulbs at least 25 years ago, and they do come back and have increased somewhat. The Leucogium have increased quite a bit. The wood hyacinths have increased somewhat in the same garden bed with no direct sun whatsoever. Paper white narcissus, for other listeners, will grow in the shade, definitely. Grape hyacinth, that's another one that did well for me for a long time. Grape hyacinth, or muscari, not only multiplies by bulb, but also reseeds itself locally, not to the point of becoming invasive, but it can, you know, sort of naturalize in your garden. Grape hyacinths have done well. The regular one is purple, but there's a bunch of variants that are lighter, lilac colored, even pink and white. And they are just really, really easy to grow. These will all take full sun if you happen to have like a normal garden bed, but they've all done well for me in the shade. So those are four right there that will do well in partial shade or even a considerable amount of shade.
Are there any things that look like three-leaf clovers?
Oh, oxalis will definitely take shade. Yeah.
It'll take shade.
Oh, yeah. I have oxalis. Now, when I say the word oxalis, there's a lot of people out there going, "You're recommending oxalis. That's the most invasive plant in California." I agree. It probably is the most invasive plant in California.
It depends on which one.
Oxalis pes capra, the Bermuda buttercup, is definitely very, very, very invasive. But there are dozens, at least 100 species in the genus oxalis, including xeric plants, caducifer plants, oxalis that have really interesting leaves and boring flowers, oxalis that have boring leaves and interesting flowers. There are a whole bunch of kinds out there. The one that I have done well with in the shade of my London plane tree is Oxalis hirta, H-I-R-T-A, which has a pink flower. More to the point, it has a very attractive light green shamrock leaf. And my plants that I put in 35 plus years ago from 1 gallon cans, I think, have spread to about 3 feet across. Oxalis hirta is the pink flowered one. There's also that burgundy red leafed one, has a white flower that's kind of pretty, but it's grown mainly for the foliage. I have a plant of that that I've had for a couple of decades. It's not really increasing that much. It just keeps coming back where it is, but that's partly because of competition from other shade ground cover type plants. So it's holding its own pretty well. But the Oxalis hirta is a really nice one. And there's others that are in the genus that are perfectly manageable garden plants and make really attractive foliage and sometimes nice flowers in the shade. There are some interesting oxalis, if you happen to be at our shop, that are in the succulent and cactus section, because they're often collected by folks who are interested in that group of plants. They're from xeric regions, xeric meaning, you know, low rainfall, very dry, hot regions. And some of them have really interesting foliage. And we're all fascinated by these plants at our nursery. So we stock them no matter how well they sell. So you'll find those over in the succulent section. Succulent collectors are an interesting group, but there are... They're mostly focused on what you all think of as classic succulents, like jade plants and things like aloes and agaves, cactus, which are succulents and so forth. But it also includes caducifers, plants that have a big swollen stem. Caudex means stem, and caducifer means it has an enlarged stem. So there are things like the Bocarnia palm, which is not a palm, ponytail palm is its common name. Big old, you know, 2 foot diameter stump trunk on this thing after many years. It's the caudex just gets very enlarged for whatever reason. Many succulent growers find that group of plants very interesting. And also the bulbs that live in these very dry regions with succulents. And which, as I say, bulbs are most commonly a drought adaptation, not a cold adaptation, a drought adaptation. And it enables them to get through anywhere from 3 to 9 months or more without rainfall, simply by storing moisture and waiting for the rains to come when they start to push up again. Some of them are so attuned to that, they have names like rain lily. They come up when it rains, they bloom, they go back down, South Africa. They wait for the next rain, they come up when it rains, they bloom again, and so forth. So they mark that kind of seasonal change.
I have really enjoyed a low-growing plant called Campanula. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole bunch of different ones. You know, some of them are upright and some are more trailing. And are there any of those that would do well in the shade?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But the area where I have the bulbs that I talked about, the dominant ground cover for years has been Campanula porcharskiana. There's a name that trips off the tongue. Porcharskiana, just like it sounds, with a couple S's and K's in there. Serbian bellflower is the common name. There's also a Dalmatian bellflower, Serbia, Dalmatia, very close. These are low trailing, round leafed, light green leaves, and they all have beautiful true blue flowers. The Dalmatian one is a lower grower that's not as vigorous or competitive. The Serbian one is vigorous and will choke out other nearby plants if it's allowed to do so. And it has this long bloom season in the spring, several weeks of bloom, and then you just kind of trim off those spent blossoms and you have attractive foliage the rest of the year. None of the campanulas are particularly drought tolerant. So I want people to know this is to go with your Japanese maples, your camellias, your ferns, your things like that. They go very well in there. And they can take full morning sun here in the valley, but afternoon sun is going to just cause the leaves to scorch and be very unattractive. So then they're fine in full shade. They actually, the campanulas in general are fine in full to medium or of course, bright shade also works as well. Campanula's common name of the group is bellflower. The old familiar one that more of you should grow is Canterbury bells. Canterbury Bells are a campanula. They're a biennial, although my experience has been they do bloom another year after the main biennial bloom. So they're really more of a short-lived perennial. And if you haven't grown them in a while, they're right up there with hollyhocks and foxgloves. It's one of those old-fashioned 19th century flowers. You should grow it at least once. You'll probably have to do it from seed because hardly any nurseries sell them. But they're in the genus Campanula, much more upright, big showy flowers in their second year. So you got to be patient. That's the thing about biennials.
So you just said that you could get Campanula seeds. What about, I mean, Canterbury Bell seeds? Can you get Campanula seeds? Can I
no, that's get some seed? Well, in theory, but I've never seen that. So they're all grown from division, but you only need one.
Oh, just one.
Yeah, divisions. They're done by division. Yeah, they're not a bulb. So, it's an herbaceous perennial that is a bunch of stems coming up from a very tight rhizome. And so you can get in there and tease them apart. You can usually just, anyone who's done this begins to realize you don't have to be real delicate with these kinds of plants. And the first time you do it, you're very carefully teasing them apart and you don't want to cut it and it takes you forever. Then you begin to realize, you know what? This plant looks a little tougher than I thought. Soak it in a bucket of water to make it easier. Take handfuls and split it if that's the easiest way for you. Or if you don't want to bother with all that, take a sharp transplanting trowel and go to the plant and sort of pull the foliage back a little bit and just stick that down in, cutting out a chunk of it, and then fill back in with soil around where you took that out. And that chunk is now your division, and you can take it off that way. They're really quite easy to divide. Timing of that would be fall or late winter.
It could do it now, couldn't I?
This is late winter.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, I think I've got my work cut out for me for the next week.
Water it in when you divide it. A lot of people are not thinking they need to water. We water to settle the soil, even though soil moisture is okay. You want to settle the soil, make that root connection with the surrounding soil. And then, of course, check daily water as needed, but probably won't need any water for at least a week or two at the rate things are going. You can still plant vegetables. There's lots of things you can plant. Any good garden center right now has leafy greens like lettuces, kale. There's usually, when we stock now, we bring in not the big-headed broccoli, but the sprouting type broccolis and broccoli rabe, things like that. Many of us have onions in six packs. I noticed nursery, my friends over at El Dorado Garden Center on the other side of the valley have onion plants. They bought in from one of the big brokers that ships them out in January. That works great. If you didn't happen to get your onions planted in November, you can go out there and get some of their onion starts and get them planted. They'll be slightly off cycle from the ones that we were selling in November because ours have already gotten a head start and are getting going. But we did this one year when we didn't have a supplier locally. We bought in from Dixondale Farms down there in Texas, one of the biggest purveyors of onions in the country. And we got them in January. We planted them out. They worked fine. So if you're still looking for onions, I'm pretty sure they still have bare root onions out at El Dorado Nursery and Garden. See if anybody does have the plants. Don't do the little bulbs. Do the plants. That's what works best. Most of us have six packs of onions. That's not the most economical way to go. But if you happen to like onions for bunching onions, green onions, that kind of thing, or just patient and want to plant out seedlings and harvest in probably late June, early July, you can do the other types as well. Lots of other vegetables you can plant now. We've got weird things like fennel. We've got a lot of interesting cool season vegetables, as do almost all garden centers in the area, because people are planting right through the winter. It's been pleasant weather more or less for that and great for the plants. As far as they're concerned, cold and high humidity is just fine. These are all cool season vegetables. So they're all very happy going in right now. Our most common question is it really okay to plant these now? The answer is yes. It is not, however, okay to plant tomatoes now.
Oh, God. You were supposed to wait for my question. Well, you've already planted the seeds of the tomatoes.
Right? We don't do that until March, but people have.
Yeah. Seeds?
Yes, okay. We do. Okay, let's go over this.
What seeds are you planting now?
Peppers.
And oh, that's plant. It.
Peppers. Peppers. They take...
Peppers, tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, peppers take like 10 to 12 weeks. Even with a greenhouse, even with a heating pad, to go from seed to having a saleable plant. So to start selling peppers in April, even though we think May is better, but to start selling peppers in April, we start them in January. And we do more in February and March and so on. But they take a long time. Anyone who's grown peppers from seed will go through this process. They come up great. And they have the first seed leaves, the cotyledon leaves. And then frequently the first true leaves come out and then they just sit there. And they sit there and they sit there. And no matter what you do, they won't grow any faster. My understanding is that commercial greenhouses will often pump the temperature up to about 80 degrees to get those little pepper seedlings to keep growing. Otherwise, they do what they do for us. We don't have a heated greenhouse. We just have a passive greenhouse. So if you happen to have a heated greenhouse, you'll get faster growth. More typically, you start them in January, you'll have plants to put out in your garden mid-April. February is still fine. We don't start tomatoes until March. And the reason for that is that they come up very quickly, especially even in a passively heated greenhouse. And when we have, you know, heating pads for them to start on, we have saleable plants in about 6 weeks from seed that we start in March. So it's just, it's too much growth if we do them too early. People who start their tomatoes in January typically have like 3 foot plants by March, and it's still too early to plant them. So we really recommend holding off on those until, oh, February, March at the earliest.
Okay. So there's an article that you sent me. It is from the Davis Enterprise. It says, getting started with fruit trees. Mm-hmm. My son planted a peach tree from a seed. Can we plant it? Will it be a peach tree? Will it make peaches? And the answer is, can plant it. It'll be a peach tree. I mean, it isn't going to change into an apple tree. And it will make peaches. Whether or not they're good or just mediocre, you don't know. And you won't know until it fruits and you eat it and you go,
that wasn't worth the effort. Here's the thing. We already mentioned this article, which you all can look at, which really is focused on, you know, choosing and training fruit trees. But this question comes up. I grew an avocado from a pit. I grew a peach tree from a pit. My kid grew a lemon from a seed. Well, each of those is a unique issue. I never discourage people from growing things like that from seed. It's fun. You can grow papayas from seed. It's one of the easiest things to sprout. Next time you buy a papaya, start the seed. But whether or not that's something to plant out in your garden and devote space to depends on, let's say, your landscape priorities. I have a couple of peach trees that came up on our property, one near the shop where my kid lives, and the fruit was good. Wasn't, you know, I'm not going to name it and market it, but it was good. It was fairly firm textured. It was white, sweet. It's a good fruit. It took us 3 years, you know, for it to fruit. They grow the first year. They'll often flower the second year, more typically the third year. And then you'll know whether this was worth the effort and the space. We've left that tree because it happens to have pretty flowers. This one's fairly showy flowers and the fruit's okay. No, I wouldn't plant it if I only had room for one peach tree, but why not leave it? And if your kid has started a peach from seed, this can be a good educational experience. There's nothing wrong with the tree. Yes, it's a peach. Yes, the fruit are peaches. Okay, it's not hybridizing with something else, so it's still a peach. It's just that when you grow it from seed, it's not the same tree you took it from. It's not going to be genetically identical to the parent. That goes to some degree for your avocado, if you happen to be doing that one, although 99 times out of 100, it's probably a seed of a Haas avocado. Pretty good chance it's self-pollinated. They do have pollinizer trees in avocado orchards, so it could be a hybrid. It'll be, in the case of an avocado, 5 to 8 years before it fruits. It's a lot of time and space to devote to something that might or might not be a suitable fruit or desirable fruit. And if it's a Haas avocado parent, I can tell you it's not actually hardy here. If you're listening in Southern California or the Bay Area, go for it. Have fun. Do it in a container, whatever you want to do. If you really want a good avocado, go out and buy a good avocado tree. If you really want a good peach, go out and buy a good peach tree. Citrus are the interesting one. Some citrus come true from seed, meaning you plant a seed of a Eureka lemon, you'll get a lemon. Some citrus do not come true from seed. You plant a seed of a Meyer lemon, you won't get a lemon. You won't get a Meyer lemon. What you get will probably be relatively inedible. In the case of citrus, the seedlings in some cases are literally clones of the parent, which is a really interesting phenomenon. And that's true for many of them. And many of them are naturally occurring hybrids, so the seedlings are not true clones of the parent. And I've got a whole list of which do and which don't, which come true from seed and which ones don't come true from seed. It's the hybrids that generally don't come true, but there's a lot of things that people don't know are hybrids. Like the grapefruit is actually a hybrid. It's not a fruit species of its own. So the seedlings from that will not come true. And they have juvenile stage, lasts 5 to 7 years when they are thorny as can be, and they don't flower and they don't fruit. So you have to wait that out, 5 to 7 years that you've got into this plant. It finally fruits, and then you find out whether it has good fruit. If you want a good lemon, go buy a lemon tree. If you want to have fun, go ahead and plant it from seed. I mean, and I have no problem with people growing weird trees from seed. Certainly one of my hobbies, but just be aware of the risk is putting a lot of time and effort into something and then not having really desirable outcome.
for some things, is it that they cross-pollinize or that they self-pollinize? Is that the difference on
part of it, yeah.
Whether it's what it is or it's something else?
The seedlings of some citrus are literally clonal seeds. They didn't even pollinize. They are clonally produced seeds, and it's fascinating because they don't have
a particular variety?
It's particular species is really what it comes down to, and how close they are to the true species seems to be the defining characteristic, knowing that many, many citrus are hybrids, as I mentioned before. But the clonally propagated seeds turned out to be really important to the industry because they don't have the virus that the tree might have. So seedlings from a tree that had been grown that they know are going to be true can be one way of getting virus out of a particular line. That's something that citrus researchers think is fascinating. The rest of us don't really have much use for that arcane bit of information, but they turned out to be really important. So a lot of studies were done on which ones do and which ones don't. As I say, I have that entire list. And they'll all sprout easily. It's surprisingly easy to grow many fruit trees from seed. On my farm, almonds, pecans, and walnuts are my major woody weeds at this point. Why? Because I planted almonds, pecans, and walnuts, and they all reseed. In the case of almonds, the seedling that comes up, there's a high likelihood that the almond will be very bitter, will have cyanide. You will not be ever using that one. They might be sweet. That's where original sweet almonds came from. Someone found, oh, hey, this one's not bitter, and we're not getting sick when we eat them. These will be good. The others have, you'll immediately know from the flavor you wouldn't use them. Bitter almond is an actual extract that's used for flavoring, because cyanide cooks off. That's an important thing to know. So even though it's bitter, the cyanide is not in what you use the bitter almond extract in. But you don't want to be eating bitter almonds. Walnuts, they vary. Some of them are good from the seedling. Some aren't so good. And you just have to wait till it finally produces and find out whether it was worth keeping that tree. My experience with seedling pecans, all of the ones that have come up on my farm have had good pecans. So that's great. But you just don't know for sure. That's why if you're a farmer, you would definitely be buying cultivated varieties, cultivars or named cultivars of each of these. But they do grow, and they're quite easy to grow, and they do produce. And then after a few years, you find out whether it was worth all that time and effort. Bearing in mind, that's where new varieties come from. You might get that one peach that is so good, you're going to put your name on it. We're going to call it Lois's Choice, and we're going to propagate it and sell it because this is the best peach you've ever had. That's a one in a million chance, but it does happen. That's where they come from. So
I think it really depends on how much room you've got.
Yes. So
I have room for two fruit trees. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the only place. I mean, they'll get enough sun there. They'll be okay, and they're not too close to anything. Mm-hmm. So I'm not gonna risk a seedling. I'm gonna get the best tree I can that will
be here. So it'll meet your criteria, be best for your situation. And that's going to be, there's a lot of factors that go into that decision matrix, which we go through with people all the time. Now, if you grow a tree from seed and it's not something you're going to put out in the garden, it's a great candidate for bonsai.
Ooh,
you've got a kid that started a tree from seed and is growing it. And we've had this whole conversation. And you're thinking, maybe this isn't something to put in the yard. Bonsai is a fascinating hobby. I urge you to consider it.
And if it's a kid, you might hook them young.
Yeah, that's right. And then they'll have something of high value 50 years from now.
Okay, so our garden quote for today, I got this book that Don got me, The Gardener's Guide to Life, Timeless Lessons Based on the Principles of Gardening, compiled and edited by Criswell Freeman. So I keep looking for things, and today I've got a whole bunch of them. The first one, Thomas Fuller says, no garden is without weeds. Okay.
Okay.
And then Ralph Waldo Emerson says, what is a weed? It's a plant whose virtues have not yet been discovered. Uh-huh. Mr. Petey says, what is a weed? For me, a weed is a plant out of place. And then Amos Pettingill, and this is my favorite one. I guess a good gardener starts out as a good weeder.
Yes, many times, indeed.
And I'm reminding you that this is January. This is weed plucking time. This is Velcro plant growing season.
It's up and vigorous. I will say that right now, as we go into February, is a good time to evaluate the place that you're planning on planting vegetables in, let's say April or May, and go out and buy a good quality tarp. and spread that out and weight it down over those grassy weeds that have come up in the winter, and I guarantee they'll be all gone by the time it's time for you to plant your vegetable garden. We're finding smothering with tarps is a really effective method of weed control on our property, and it takes about 6 weeks. This is what we've done. I did some areas where 2 weeks. Okay, that they fell down, but they didn't die. 3 weeks. Okay, they fell down. A lot of them died, but a lot of them came back. So it wasn't very effective. 4 weeks was beginning to get really effective. 6 weeks covered with a tarp, with adequate soil moisture and normal temperatures, I guess, gave complete weed control of the annual weeds that come up with the winter. Now, this isn't going to smother your Bermuda grass now because it's dormant, but it will do a good job on those winter annual weeds. So that's something to think about is over the next few weeks, figure out where everything is going to go. Get a tarp with grommets so you can attach it securely, and that will smother out the weeds. Just a quick programming note, there was a power failure at the station a couple weeks ago, knocked the station off the air. The station came back on, broadcasting resumed, but the website was essentially destroyed. So KDRT.org was not functional. And as a consequence, a couple of the podcasts got delayed or out of order. It all depends on how you get the Davis Garden Show as a podcast. Some of you might have missed one. So if you feel like something was missing, you can head on over, since I continue to upload and maintain that podcast directory, davisgardenshow.com. I do give a brief summary of what the topics were. If one of them sounds unfamiliar, you could click on it right there and listen to it on your computer, or even download it and save it for later. This was an odd situation where the station was broadcasting fine from the studios, and things were, we think, archiving correctly, but the shows that were created and uploaded remotely were just held back. So if something's missing or you feel like you missed something, davisgardenshow.com, and you'll find all the links there.
So I don't know if you care, Don. I don't know if our listeners care, but I had a birthday last Sunday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Lois. Happy birthday to you.
How are you getting the vibrato in there, Don? That was wonderful. So I'm going to be 76. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore. And Lois Richter here at KDRTLP 95.7 in Davis, California.
We have a catered alert. You are cordially invited to meet and mix with friendly KDRT volunteers and fans at the January Suds and Sounds meet and greet. You can join them there Wednesday, January 28th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Armadillo Music on F Street between 2nd and 3rd in downtown Davis. Suds and Sounds happens on the last Wednesday of most months. Mark your calendars and join the KDRT crew.